the field of healthcare is a sacred profession, although most physicians do not swear to the original Hippocratic Oath, the majority of doctors do take an oath, usually when they graduate from medical school. And one of the promises within that oath is, first, do no harm. But even with this oath, Americans do not feel immense faith in medicine, and we're exploring why that is and what can be done about it on this Hour of the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a poster presentation last week at the International Stroke Conference, stroke knowledge is similar among residents from the north side and south side of Chicago, but those who lived on the south side were less likely to call 911 because of financial costs and mistrust of hospitals. Dr. Dhruv Kular is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy and Research. He recently wrote a piece for the New York Times. It's titled, Do You Trust the Medical Profession? A Growing Distrust Could Be Dangerous to Public Health and Safety. Dr. Kular, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you this morning.
Well, I'd like to read a statistic you cite in your piece. You write that in 1966, more than three quarters of Americans had great confidence in medical leaders. Today, only 34% do. So as a physician, what is your reaction when you hear numbers like this?
You know, it's in part expected in some ways, and it's in part really unfortunate. And so the reason that I became interested in this issue and the reason that I wanted to write about it and draw attention to it is that trust in one another and trust in institutions across the board has been falling for decades. And that's true of the media, that's true of the government, that's true of religious institutions. And so in a way, it's not so surprising that our faith in American medicine has also declined over the past few decades. But as I write, that kind of mistrust can have real negative consequences for public health and for public safety.
How does this compare with other developed nations?
You know, Americans have always been somewhat more distrusting of institutions than other developed countries. And so if you look at us compared to other countries, we have much lower levels of trust in our healthcare system as a whole. We also have relatively lower levels of trust in the medical profession specifically. But we do continue to have pretty high levels of trust in our own doctors. And so it's kind of a paradox of American trust in that we do trust our own physicians. We're generally satisfied with our own medical care. But when you look at trust across the health system in medical leaders and the medical profession in the healthcare system as a whole, that is very low in America.
Perhaps there's relationship building in that trust with the physician. Does that factor into it?
I think so. And I think, you know, when we get to know, you know, as a physician and having worked with a number of doctors and nurses and at hospitals, I see how hard a lot of clinicians work and how they do have the best interests of patients in mind. And so it's not surprising to me that once patients enter a clinic or a hospital, they are generally satisfied and they are generally trusting of that individual who's providing care to them. But there's a number of reasons that when you step back and people look at the health system as a whole, they're much less trusting, and that also can have negative consequences.
The medical field, of course, isn't just physicians. As you mentioned, it encompasses lots of other different professions. Who do we tend to trust the most, and who do we tend to trust the least?
So nurses have been the most trusted profession for a very long time, and that continues to be the case. So within healthcare as well, nurses are the individuals that patients often spend the most time with. They're cared for most directly by them, and they continue to trust them more than any other profession within the medical system. They continue to trust doctors at relatively high rates, but insurers and pharmaceutical companies fall very low on the levels of trust.
Well, pharmaceutical companies, of course, have a direct connection to physicians who are prescribing those drugs and sometimes getting a return in form of cash or some other payoff from delivering those prescriptions. Does that have an impact?
That's the perception that doctors, their decisions to prescribe particular drugs are influenced by pharmaceutical companies. That certainly leads to higher levels of mistrust in the medical profession. Pharmaceutical companies, there's been a lot of rollback of the extent to which they can try to infiltrate and change the drugs that physicians are prescribing directly. They're not allowed to do some of the things that they were in the past. But that perception, I think, continues to last. And so one of the ways that we can try to rebuild some of that trust is to have very clear and transparent communication, as well as disclosing any conflicts of interest. So if a doctor does happen to be consulting for an insurer or a pharmaceutical company, disclosing that information up front so that patients know about it has been shown to increase the level of trust in that relationship.
Dr. Dhruv Kular is with us. He's a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, a researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy and Research. Recently wrote about trust in the medical profession in the New York Times. Gathering your insights on trust in medicine at 800-642-1234. Do you trust your doctor? Why or why not? What about trust in the broader medical profession, the industry? Why do you think Americans have become less trustful of the medical profession? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Kular, what happens, what are the consequences, the tangible consequences that you've seen when trust is broken between doctor and patient? What happens?
So trust really is at the heart of any doctor-patient relationship. And so I think it's the most important thing that we can have when we're caring for our patients. And when patients don't trust their doctors, they're much less likely to follow treatment plans, for instance. So patients who have high levels of trust, they're much more likely to be taking their medications. They're much more likely to do the rehab exercises that they need to do, change their behavior in certain healthful ways, like exercising more or eating more healthfully. And so trust is really important for getting patients to follow treatment plans and change behavior in certain ways. Now, trust is also important for patients to engage in other activities that are helpful. For instance, getting the flu shot. It's a bad flu season this year. Getting the flu shot is more likely if you trust your doctor or the medical profession. Getting your children vaccinated against things like measles is also associated with trust. And then more broadly, coming forward when you need medical care, before you even enter the medical system, but the decision to seek care, to get tested, to get screened for cancers is also associated with trust. So at the individual level, we're less likely to follow treatment plans, we're less likely to engage in healthful behavior, we're less likely to come forward to get screened when we don't have high levels of trust in our doctors and our health system.
Pediatricians have also had to deal, as you mentioned, with the consequences of parents who may not follow the schedule of vaccinations for their baby and their children. That has consequences on a child who, is not the one making the decision.
It's true, and that's problematic for two reasons. One is that parents are making that decision on behalf of their children, which could possibly negatively affect the health of their child, but it also negatively affects the health of children within that community. And so when one parent makes a decision that their child isn't going to get vaccinated, if enough parents make that decision, other children are also affected by that decision.
Dr. Dhruv Kular is with us, a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He recently wrote about eroding trust in the medical profession in the New York Times. Gathering your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you trust your physician? What about trust in the broader healthcare industry? Have you taken a doctor's orders and sought out a second opinion or gone to the internet? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. According to a study last year published in the journal Ethnicity and Disease, perceived discrimination strongly influences patient response to healthcare providers and may account for the greater mistrust, dissatisfaction, and negative perceptions of providers reported by African Americans compared with Caucasians. The researchers found links between trust, satisfaction, and perceptions of discrimination from providers. We'll talk about it right after this news update. Trust in medicine is very instructive. It is one of the best predictors of whether patients follow a doctor's advice about things like exercise, smoking cessation, and condom use. Mistrust can lead people to skipping the flu shot or not following the full vaccination schedule for a child. These have potentially serious consequences for individuals and the population as a whole. That's according to our guest this hour of the morning show. Dr. Dhruv Kular is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy and Research. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How much faith do you have in America's healthcare system? How much trust do you have in your own doctor? Do you avoid going to the doctor, perhaps because you lack trust in medicine or other factors? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Troy, who joins us from Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Yes, good morning. I would like to say that I think that there's a connection there with nurses, and I think because a lot of nurses, they kind of climb the socioeconomic status when they go to become nurses. And I noticed in Wisconsin that a lot of the doctors lean very right, especially in, like, suburban areas. And a lot of these nurses, they hear a lot of the conversations that these doctors have behind closed doors or, like, when they're on the operating table, they'll have conversations. And a lot of these nurses, two sister-in-laws that are nurses. And they say that some of the ways, it's almost like a lot of these doctors have a lot of dissent for their patients that are low income, or they have, you know, they're very political, and they kind of tied in with a lot of big money and special interests. And I just think that leaks into the families of these, these people who are nurses. They go home and they tell their families, and they talk about a lot of the things that these doctors say.
Troy, thanks for the call. Let's get Dr. Kular to respond here. And providing medicine across the socioeconomic divides that we see in America.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. You know, I think for the most part, when I've been interacting with my colleagues, that isn't the focus of the discussion. And you know, one of the mandates of medicine is to provide medical care equally to people of all levels of the socioeconomic spectrum, as well as all backgrounds and ethnicities. It is the case that the perception that nurses are less beholden to a number of special interests, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or insurers, I can see why the perception that doctors would be more beholden to those interests would be the case and could be problematic. But for the most part, doctors are actually now equally split across the political system. And so about half of doctors lean to the right, about half of doctors lean to the left. And so there certainly isn't that kind of dominant influence at this time, whereas in the past, that was perhaps more the case, where doctors leaned one way more than the other. But today, they're pretty evenly split.
Well, let's look past and present here. In the 60s, if you received a diagnosis from a physician, you sort of had to trust it. You might get a second opinion, but the internet wasn't there. Now you get a diagnosis in 2018, you jump online. You get all kinds of information, for better or for worse, and find out about all the possible treatment options. You can educate yourself. How has technology played a role in all of this?
That's a great point, and it is really an important change over the last few decades. Now, patients have a good deal more knowledge about certain diseases, about certain treatments, than they did in the past. I don't think that necessarily has to reduce levels of trust in medicine or in healthcare. I think it actually provides a great opportunity for doctors and patients to have an informed conversation when they're together in the clinic or in the hospital. I think more generally the way that access to information and media and the internet have changed the doctor-patient relationship is more perceptions of the medical profession or healthcare at a large, at a high level. And so we're now exposed to many different things, many different interests and players in the health system in the way that we probably weren't a few decades ago. We're now exposed to all the nitty-gritty of those types of things, and part of that is good. We're more informed, but part of that can also lead to more distrust.
Well, Jim from Manitowoc called in but couldn't stay with us, and he wants to know how patients can find out how much money or incentives doctors receive from pharmaceuticals. Who can we ask, and should we require some sort of disclosure? Is there some type of database out there to find out what, you know, to look at transparency?
That's right, and that's a great point. And when patients have access and they understand what a doctor's financial relationships are, that is actually a good way to increase trust. So there is something called the Sunshine Act, and the Sunshine Act is a federal law that is essentially designed to increase transparency around the financial relationships that physicians have, that teaching hospitals have, that manufacturers of drugs and medical devices have. And so there is a Sunshine Act in which doctors and hospitals are supposed to be disclosing these types of relationships and that patients can have access to.
Let's go to Carissa now in Green Bay. Hi, Carissa.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to share a comment that sometimes I feel that it could be the physician's attitude, too, that could impact trust. From our own personal experience, the doctors that we have now are ones that have taken the time to really talk to us and make sure we understand our options and all the different options that are out there, and they've been very clear about that. We had an experience with a doctor when my father had to go to the emergency room that the physician, my sister is an oncology nurse. I work in andrology research. We have science backgrounds, and we had asked him some questions, and he ultimately just kind of ego-fluffed himself and didn't want to explain it. And he said, well, ultimately, it's, I just know. And that's a terrible answer to give a family that's concerned about their father.
Well, it sounds like the physician was also rushed. And it reminds me of Carissa, her thoughts here is that there was this hashtag that was trending, shared over 2 billion times, for people in the Medicaid community to share their name when they first interface with a patient.
That's a good point. And Carissa, thank you for that comment. You know, I think clear, transparent, empathic communication is one of the most important things that we do as clinicians and as doctors. And so to the extent that we're able to communicate about what we're doing, why we're doing it, give families and patients an understanding, that really builds a great deal of rapport and a great deal of trust. And so people's trust in medicine, but also in all other fields, depends kind of on answering three questions. It depends on answering the question, do you know what you're doing? It depends on answering, will you tell me what you're doing? And then are you doing it to help me or help yourself? And so I think doctors and all clinicians need to try to implicitly or explicitly answer those three questions when we're having a conversation with our patients.
How much of this interpersonal communication and transparency that we're talking about, how much of that is built into the medical school experience?
You know, medical school curriculums are more and more trying to introduce this type of thing, recognizing that it's not just how much you know, or it's not just how good of a surgeon or a proceduralist you are. It's also your ability to take people through an illness, through a disease, help them understand what's going on, how to get better so they can get back to the lives that they want to live. And so I think we're recognizing that that is a really central part of medicine. We need to emphasize that in medical training. And so I think that kind of thing is happening more and more today than it was in the past.
Dr. Dhruv Kular is with us. He's a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and he's recently been writing about mistrust in medicine. It's published in the New York Times. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What could the medical profession do to gain more trust? Does the cost of medicine, your medical bills, does that influence your level of trust in medicine? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Steve emailed and said, medical providers are generally perceived as trustworthy. It's the for-profit insurance industry that is untrustworthy. Let's not confuse or conflate healthcare providers with the vampires of the so-called health insurance industry. Dr. Kular?
So it is true that insurers and pharmaceutical companies generally have lower, much lower levels of trust than do healthcare providers. And as I mentioned, the relationships that patients build with their own doctor and their own nurses, those are some of the most trusting relationships that we have. When we get into looking at the broader healthcare system and the players and how they interact with one another, that's where a lot of these problems start to arise, but that can still have very negative consequences for patients and the population as a whole.
What do you see as the consequences here when it comes to public health specifically? And let's talk about one specific example, first of all, with the flu. Here we are in the midst of a very bad flu outbreak this country has seen in some time. And do you see trust involved, a lack of trust in the medical profession, perhaps, with this outbreak?
I do. And, you know, as you mentioned, it is the one of the worst flu seasons that we've had for some time now. Part of that is people not getting vaccinated at high rates. Part of that is not having the most effective vaccination this year as compared to other vaccines. But the willingness of people to engage in certain behaviors, like getting a flu shot, like interacting with the medical system, is powerfully influenced by whether or not they trust the institution as a whole. Now, there was a very interesting study that I talked about in the article that I wrote, talking about trust in institutions as it related to the Ebola epidemic. And so researchers looked at people in Liberia, and they looked at how much they trusted the government, how much and how willing they were to take the recommended precautions to prevent the spread of Ebola. What they found was that people who trusted the government less, people who were more mistrusting of the institution, were much less likely to engage in precautions to prevent the spread of Ebola. Now, these people, they didn't have any less of an understanding of what Ebola was. They didn't have more erroneous beliefs. They just trusted less. And so I think that kind of thing happens everywhere. It happens in all countries for all types of diseases. And when we trust institutions less, we're less likely to engage in some of these precautions, whether it's a flu vaccine, whether it's other types of behaviors, and that can have real problems across the population.
Let's go to Duke now, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Duke.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Well, I got, I guess, an anecdote. I used to be a phlebotomist for a clinical lab in Northern Illinois. And what my job was to go around and do mobile blood draws and EKGs was is that there were groups of physicians that would order unnecessary tests, and then they would get paid to, quote, read the tests. Now, these tests, these blood draws that I were doing were on people that were terminal. I mean, you could see that they had only a couple of days left, and yet here I was doing a full battery of tests on them. And it was all basically so that the doctor could get paid. And I noticed that in recent times, that every time I go to see a doctor, no matter what ailment I have, they always refer me to another doctor within the same network. And I know that they could basically diagnose what I have, but they put me off to somebody else. It's like a big money-making scheme. So I don't really have any trust in doctors because of that.
Duke, thank you for calling in. Dr. Kular, your perception.
So, you know, I think it's a complicated issue in the sense that we don't necessarily know the clinical situation in which those tests were being ordered. You know, even people at the end of their life, there are times at which you would want blood draws, you would want some information depending on the goals of care in that situation. I don't think that for the most part doctors are engaging in the type of that type of behavior. I think for the most part, they are well-meaning. They are people that want to do the best by their patients. Now, are there isolated incidents? Sure, there are in any profession. But for the most part, I think kind of the dominant ethos of medicine and of doctors and of nurses is still to do the best that they can by their patients.
You also write in your piece that low levels of trust among patients can hurt innovation in the medical field. How so?
Yeah, so I think we often think of medical innovation as something that is driven by doctors and scientists and entrepreneurs. These are the people that are coming up with new treatments and devices and technologies. But what we don't often recognize is that it's also important that patients engage with these new types of therapies. And so for these things to spread, it has to be the case that patients are also willing to use them, to try a new medicine, to try a new device, to try a new technology. And they're only going to do that if they trust that the therapy is effective and they trust that the person giving them that therapy, that they have their best interests in mind. And so there's been studies that have been done, for instance, with cancer patients that show that one of the most important predictors of whether a patient will agree to enter into a clinical trial is whether or not they trust their physician. And that belief is as important as the belief that the treatment will actually help them. And so today I think about things like wearable devices and electronic medical records and telemedicine. And there's a lot of money that's going into these technologies, but it's very important that patients trust that their data will be kept secure. It'll be private, that they think these technologies are actually useful. Those are the real barriers, I think, to broader use, broader acceptance of these new types of technologies.
Basically, it comes down to everything in the medical field, like so many things in life, comes down to trusting other people. And we've heard in recent weeks, trust can run way afoul, as in the case of former USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, who violated the trust and the bodies of young athletes, as we learned from his sentencing hearing last week. Dr. Dhruv Kular is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, wrote about mistrust in medicine recently in the New York Times. Your insights, 800-642-1234. What could the medical profession do to gain your trust? Join in at WPR Mornings. Tweet us. We'll be back after the news. There is a fine line between being on your guard when it comes to your health and being paranoid to the point that it's counterproductive for your health and well-being. We are talking about this fine line and how to build trust in the medical profession this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a 2016 investigation by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, more than 2,400 doctors nationwide have been sanctioned for sexual misconduct involving patients between 1999 and 2015, yet over half still maintain active medical licenses, even after allegations were proven to be true. Physician Dhruv Kular stays with us as we navigate mistrust in medicine and gathering your thoughts at 800-642-1234. How could the medical profession gain your trust? What should America's healthcare system do about a pervasive lack of trust? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're supposed to believe that our doctors are always looking out for us, Dr. Kular, and yet one of the biggest stories in recent weeks has been that of a doctor using his power in an absolutely horrific way. Dr. Larry Nassar, the former USA Gymnastics and Michigan State doctor, was sentenced last week to 40 to 175 years in prison after more than 160 women and girls said in court that he sexually abused them over the past two decades under the guise of medical treatment. And we'd like to play this clip of Nassar speaking on a 2013 gymnastics podcast, talking about the role of trust and care between him and his patients.
Not just physically, but mentally, you have to protect your athletes. You have to let them know that we care. You have to not let them know, but let them feel it. Let them understand it. Let them breathe it. It's there. You know, it's not just a pat on the back. You know what I mean? It has to be sincere that we care.
How do you see the actions of one doctor who committed something so absolutely evil under the guise of care affecting how we view the entire medical profession?
Yeah, it is, you know, it's such a sad and horrific story. And it really just violates the most kind of sacred parts of medicine, which is patients come to you expecting that you're going to act in their best interest, that they're able to trust you as a physician. And so it goes against everything that the medical profession stands for. You know, I hope that the actions of this one person don't have a ripple effect to the rest of the medical profession. You know, there are other instances of this type of thing, but they're relatively rare and isolated. This situation that was now kind of come to justice finally, but you know, I don't think it should have the kind of effect to the rest of the medical profession because of this one man's action.
Let's go to Bill, who joins us from Brookfield. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to comment about lack of trust in doctors. I'm in my mid-60s, and my original doctor had saved my life with an illness I had one time. And then he retired and sold the business to another doctor. And this fellow pitched the records. The records are gone. So then they went over to electronic records, and nothing is transcribed. And so you go to your doctor. We all go to our doctors and think that they're really looking out for what's in our best interest, and yet they don't have a clue. They have nothing to go by. They just want to take more tests for stuff you've already been tested for.
So, Bill, you saw a real fallout when you went from records being perhaps on paper over to electronic records, that you had to retell your whole story of your medical history again.
Right. You know, they have none of the doctor's notes. You know, they have none of the records. They, you know, it's gone. And they go to this electronic stuff, and they sit and look at their computers. You know, you go to visit your doctor, and he sits and looks at a computer, you know, and there's nothing there.
Bill, thank you. Dr. Kular.
Well, Bill, you know, I'm sorry that you had that experience, and it sounds like a really frustrating one. You know, things like that are not uncommon in the sense that as we transition from paper records to electronic records, sometimes some information is lost. I think one of the things that your story highlights is that having that relationship with your doctor was really important, your first doctor, and having told your story, having reached a level of understanding with that individual was really important, and how frustrating it can be when you have to rebuild that type of relationship the second time over again. And so I'm sorry for that frustrating experience.
And it seems like electronic records has a lot of efficiencies involved, but maybe it falls down in the area of connecting with the patient and really listening.
It's true. And you know, like most things in medicine and in healthcare, there are pros and there are cons to electronic medical records. There are opportunities to make care more powerful, more efficient. At the same time, a lot of doctors and patients are frustrated by electronic medical records, particularly with this idea that that Bill brought up, that a lot of people are now forced to look into a computer when they're with their patients as well. And that can be frustrating for all parties in the exam room or the hospital room. And so I think it's something that we need to think a lot more about. Can we design these to be more user-friendly? Can we design them to open up more time for doctors and patients to talk as opposed to less time for them to talk?
Let's go to Bob, who joins us in Franklin. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I recently had a physical exam and a blood work, which is a screening procedure. My insurance covers screening procedures 100%. I got the information back from the insurance company, said the payment was denied because the doctor didn't code it as screening, he coded it as diagnostic. So now I have to go through the battle of trying to get this paid for when, you know, for the last 5 years, it's been paid for 100%. Now, this is something that's happened to me several times with several different doctors, and I don't know why anybody would want to trust them after that.
Bob, thank you for the call. Coding errors, Dr. Kular.
Yeah, Bob, that's another frustrating situation. You know, part of that, I think, kind of touches on trust, but it's not central to it in the sense that, you know, coding is not something that doctors like to do either, and they're often focused on trying to provide care for patients. And so when they are entering these codes, they're not always sure exactly what the insurer wants. I hope that that type of thing can get cleared up because screening certainly is something that should be covered and should be covered free of charge. But those codes, they can be confusing and they can be things that lead to these types of problems. One suggestion might be to tell the next doctor you see or the next time you're getting this test that you've had this problem in the past, and to make sure that they code it in a way that is in line with what the insurer might want.
Dr. Kular, how can we turn this conversation now and look at how do we build trust between patients and physicians, patients and the medical community? How can it be rebuilt? Where do we begin?
Sure. I think the place that we need to start, as with most things in healthcare, is between clinicians and patients. And so I think that is where we start to maintain trust and we start to build trust. And so the few things that people want to know when they go to their doctor is, are they competent? Are they going to be transparent? And are they going to have their best interests in mind? So as much as we can emphasize those three things in any patient encounter, the better. Part of that has to do with having really transparent communication and conversation. Part of that has to do with disclosing conflicts of interest. So if you do have financial conflicts, making sure that patients know about that. part of this has to do with creating an expectation for a long-term relationship. And so I think Bill mentioned that having told his story to one doctor, he was frustrated when he had to shift to another doctor. So as much as we can try to maintain those long-term relationships, the better. And then the final thing that I would say is that we want to do what we can to promote kind of shared interests between the medical profession and patients and reduce some of the power differences that a lot of people perceive. And there are many ways to do that. One is giving patients easier access to their medical notes and their medical records so that they feel more in control of their care, that they can trust what their providers are kind of putting in the medical record. Another is this area of research. And so a lot of the mistrust in medicine over time has developed in part because of the way that research is perceived. A lot of patients feel like research is being done on them as opposed to with them. And so partnering with patients, partnering with communities to give them a greater say in the goals of research, the design of research, the dissemination of research, that type of thing can ease some of the mistrust that we have as well.
In the final moments of our conversation, how do you build trust with your patients?
The most important thing that I've always emphasized is communicating clearly with them. And so telling them when I know what the diagnosis is, telling them when I don't know what the diagnosis is, helping them through the steps of disease and treatment. I think what people want to know is that you're doing all you can to help them get better. You know, it won't always be the case that you know exactly what's wrong or what to do. It won't always be the case that we are able to get to a place where we get a cure. But it should always be the case that you have their best interests in mind, that you're going to do whatever you can to make their life better.
Dr. Kular, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dhruv Kular is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, a researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy and Research. He recently wrote a piece for the New York Times. It's titled, "Do You Trust the Medical Profession? A Growing Distrust Could Be Dangerous to Public Health and Safety." This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina, Nyasia Ellison, and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.